This is Canadian Wealth Wisdom by TriDelta Private Wealth. My name is Kyle Taylor, Wealth Advisor and Portfolio Manager with TriDelta. I am joined by Paul Simon, Head of Fixed Income. Paul has spent the past 6 years with TriDelta and previously worked with CI Investments in a career that spans 25 years. Paul also obtained his CFA designation in 2004. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm glad to be back with you.
Before we begin, it should be noted that this podcast is intended for general information only and not as specific investment advice. You should always speak to an investment professional to determine the appropriateness of any investment or investment strategy and how it relates to your specific situation. That said, the TriDelta team welcomes a conversation to learn more. The purpose of this series is to discuss recent market developments, what we are watching, and ultimately what action TriDelta is taking within our own client portfolios. In our recent market commentary, we discussed the dramatic policy changes in the U.S., how Canada and other countries are reacting to tariffs, and the impact this uncertainty has had on bond markets. Paul, keeping it specific to the U.S. market for now, how have bond markets been treating this trade uncertainty?
Well, Kyle, I think we have to understand that the bond market is an amalgam of all the information we receive. And of course, the tariff news is most topical. We get a new headline every day. And it's probably contributing the most volatility to interest rate markets, particularly in the U.S. But it is a synthesis of a number of effects and changes that we're seeing in the economy, policymaking-wise, and the response that markets are having to those changes. Just generally speaking, the shape of the U.S. interest rate curve has steepened. That is to say, the near-term interest rates, short-term interest rates have come down somewhat in 2025, about 50 basis points, depending on what part of the curve you're talking about. And they've gone up about 25 basis points in the long end of the curve. It doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a very rare trade in the bond market because it signals a couple of things. It signals not a lot of transparency of what's going to be happening in the distant future and a fair amount of certainty of what it's going to be happening in the near future. And I guess the most simplistic reading of that would be that the uncertainty, the changes in trade policy, the changes in taxation policy, some of the geopolitical risks are all combining to have markets expect interest rates will have to come down near term to support an economy that's encountering these challenges. And then beyond that, if we were just going to look at the tariff issue, we'd say the market's also pricing in a premium for money in the out years, assuming that higher taxation and tariff regime, higher costs of production and sales mean more inflation in the future. So the market is doing its best to discount all of these changes that are evolving, but it is a very noisy environment in which we're investing today.
Yeah, noisy is a good way to sum it up. One of the items we talked about in our Q2 commentary was around the U.S. 30-year rates surpassing 5%. How much of that uncertainty was due to the U.S. tax bill, the Trump's big, beautiful bill?
Right. So you bring up the second, and I think equally perplexing development for bond markets, which was the passage of that secondary budget bill. Depending on who you read, it's going to be $2.5 to $3.5 trillion of incremental debt added to the federal government debt stock. While in the near term, that's likely to have some deleterious effects to the economy, supportive effects going into 2026, it certainly didn't do much to quell the fear of bond investors with respect to debt servicing and debt stability at the U.S. federal level. So that taken in tandem with the tariff situation, and one other thing that I think is not really talked about much in the media, which is the stickiness of inflation that we've witnessed. Despite the fact that we're encountering these challenges and we're supposed to be probably 6 quarters into a decelerating economy, I think all of those three things taken together have caused the cost of money to go up longer term. And in the bond markets, we refer to something called the term premium. You know, what do you charge additionally for taking my money for a longer period of time? And you know, the uncertainties that come along with what's going to evolve economically in the interim until I get it back. It's putting pressure to the upside on long rates. That U.S. 30-year Treasury rate has pierced 5% a few times this year. 5% in of itself doesn't sound like too prohibitive a debt servicing rate, but it is much higher than we've had to deal with over the past 20 years or so, and it sort of earmarks a return to a more normalized shape of the yield curve. And the reality is a lot of entities, particularly governments, aren't currently set up to meaningfully, effectively service debt at 5% or higher over the long haul. So bond investors need to get compensated for those risks, and the market is proactively pricing in those risks.
Yeah, you bring up the adding to the U.S. deficit, and I mean that's not something that's necessarily new. But I'm wondering, you know, we keep seeing for the last decade really about debt sustainability and the debt levels, not only in the U.S. but elsewhere. But the one thing I don't see anybody talking about is, how do we know when the tipping point is? Is there anything that can signal to us that, you know, that might be a near-term issue, could still be a longer-term issue? Of course, the U.S. is in a bit of a different spot because they are the global authority on for monetary policy. What would you say to that?
That is the $100,000 question.
And
more than that. The trillion-dollar question. Most of my career, I've contemplated this issue because debt sustainability has been really at the core of capital formation while I've been in the markets the past 25 years. Each successive crisis that we've experienced, going back to the tech wreck, even before that with the savings and loans, but also, you know, the 2008 experience, the PIX crisis in Europe, at its core, it always gets back to debt sustainability, usually in the government sector, sometimes in the banking sector, occasionally in the consumer sector. The types of things that would signal to us that there is a problem, and luckily for us, we have a real world example for this in the G10 today. We'll talk about in a second. First of all, you look at currency volatility. If you don't have confidence in a particular country or government or central bank or regime, the first thing you're going to do is try to get out of that currency as quickly as possible, because you have no idea what the underlying cash flows are going to mean. You know, as your ability to collect on claims is challenged. So you would look at currency volatility, and certainly we've seen a fair bit of that throughout 2025. I'm sure we're going to talk about the US dollar at some point. So that would be one thing I'd keep an eye on. The second thing I would look at is the smooth functioning of money markets. And anyone who was around in 2008 knows what that's like. That's when banks can't lend or borrow money overnight when they need to balance their books. That's when they have to go to their central bank for support, just to prevent runs on the banks. Those are the types of things you would look at if you were going to add into a sort of a government debt crisis or something along those lines. And then there's some other finer sort of market minutiae. We look at things like swap spreads and basis swap spreads between currencies that tell you that there's some meaningful distress in the markets. I'm glad to tell you that we don't see a whole lot of those today, aside from the currency volatility, which has been much higher than it's been in recent years. But it's what I spend a lot of my time monitoring to make sure that we're not heading for something more nefarious than we've already experienced.
Can I guess that your G10 example was the UK?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Details of that might be a little bit beyond this, but I just wanted to make sure I was on the same page. So staying with the US for a little while longer, even early in July at the time of recording this, there are always feels like renewed rumblings of what's Trump going to do with Fed Chair Jerome Powell. Do you see that as a risk for the market? Do you think it's more noise, or do you think that he's going to be able to finish his term come May?
So the statutes regarding the relationship between the executive branch and the Federal Reserve are very well established, and this isn't the first time the relationship has been challenged openly and even litigiously in the past. We know that Chairman Powell cannot be forced to leave for arbitrary reasons. I know that the president recently posited there might be fraud going on with the renovation of the Federal Reserve's offices, and maybe he'll have to leave for that. But there's no precedent for that. And really, by the time they got to the end of some sort of examination that way, his term as chairman would already be over. I know they're talking about wishing that he would leave because his 15-year term isn't up. So once he's no longer chairman, he could still be a member of the board. But at the end of the day, the president's going to have an opportunity to appoint a person to the board come May. And when that happens, it's not going to meaningfully shift the composition of that board, even if that person is the noisiest person in the room. I will say I've never seen a more consolidated Fed in the face of outside pressures than I'm witnessing right now. And the Fed doesn't have an homogenous view right now on policymaking or the economy. I read a commentator earlier this week said policymaking in the current environment has never been less forward-looking, and I think that's very true because of the changes in policy, tariffs and taxes, because of the geopolitical risks, because a lot of the bluster that's going on in the media, they don't have a clear read on how the economy is evolving. So all they can do is depend on the data, and the data is signaling to them, at least for the time being, the economy isn't tanking. We do see some tendrils of residual strength in the consumer sector, and inflation is probably not decelerating as quickly as they would like. And so I don't see a way for the president to meaningfully sway the Fed from this path. And I don't think the Fed's being obstinate either. They've said, you know, we think we're going to have to ease in the back half of this year, but the way things are right now, better to be cautious. And I would think that that's what's eventually going to eventuate here. But we'll have to see.
And the other side of this equation, and you mentioned it a little bit, is the confidence in the U.S. dollar. To the end of 2024, we were actually discussing how returns for Canadian investors had been boosted by a strengthening U.S. dollar. To the end of June in 2025, the U.S. dollar index, as measured by DXY, is down 10.7%. What has been the driving this weakening U.S. dollar? Has been the loss of confidence, flight from dollar-denominated assets? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think chief among them has been the loss of the patina that the U.S. dollar has had as the world's reserve currency. You know, part and parcel of being designated as the world's reserve currency is to offer the world some certainty and stability around its value and the policymaking framework that surrounds it. When you start talking about tearing up decades-old trade agreements and potentially arbitrarily taxing foreign ownership of U.S. dollar-denominated assets, it doesn't help foreign investors sleep very well at night. And I think all of that happened at a time when, and I think we talked about this probably at the end of 2024, where we were exiting a lengthy period of U.S. dollar denominated asset outperformance that in many ways made a lot of sense, but brought us to some valuation metrics that were a little bit uncomfortable in historical context. And most investors, I think, were looking for a reason to diversify away from U.S. dollar-denominated assets back into some of the more unloved regions like Europe. And the timing could not be worse, given what was going on with Liberation Day. And then I think if you pair that up with, you know, a bit of a patriotic tilt, whether it be mandated or otherwise, in the face of all this uncertainty, to look for some more investment opportunities at home from the parts of the world that do have excess investment capital, it was the perfect time to de-dollarize. And that's really been the trade this year, de-dollarization. I think it's the U.S. dollar did get a little bit oversold, and the market did sort of rejoice the more conciliatory tone that President Trump struck when he delayed this most recent tariff deadline. But I think that perhaps that horse has left the barn, if for no other reason, for relative opportunity and relative valuation reasons.
It's interesting, too, because on one hand, you have a weakening U.S. dollar that's hurt returns for Canadian investors. But on the other hand, if you look at the kind of inner workings of the S&P 500, many of their large companies generate a lot of revenue internationally. So, you know, an example that we used in our commentary was Apple. They generate over 60% of their revenues internationally. So when you convert those back to U.S. dollars, it actually could provide a bit of a near-term earnings boost for them, which is sort of an interesting dynamic despite the volatility going on in the U.S. dollar. Moving on to Canada and how we're positioned in our bond portfolios, has anything changed for you in terms of what you're looking at in your models?
The short answer is no. I think there is a bit of symmetry between what's gone on in stock markets and corporate credit markets. As the year has gone on, as the markets have become more inured to some of the headline risk, at the end of the day, there is still a lot of investment capital seeking relatively non-volatile passive income. And that's been incredibly supportive of credit spreads in the high-grade space. You know, investment grade spreads are within a stone's throw of where they were pre-COVID, you know, depending on what metric you want to use. I think the synthetic indices were, you know, 45 basis points of credit spread, you know, just prior to COVID, blew out to about 150 basis points through COVID, and today sit at around 50 basis points. And I would posit that, you know, that period leading into COVID had less exogenous shock risk than we have today with all the changes going on in policy. So I wouldn't say you're getting richly compensated to be in the investment grade space, but it's a safe place to hide out. Credit quality in the high grade space in Canada is particularly good. And so we're still advocating for clients to you know, direct their the lion's share of their fixed income allocation that way. And aside from that, I think there are opportunistic chances, opportunities with you know, single names where the story might make a little bit of sense. You kind of have to look for idiosyncratic themes, whether it be particular industry challenges or refinancing risk or something along those lines, where you might get something a little bit more cheaply in the investment grade space, but you're still looking at 4-ish, 4.25, you know, on average returns in that square.
And I wanted to ask also about preferred shares again. So Canadian prefs finished 2024 up almost 25% and have continued to see gains in 2025. Is the story the same around the redemptions, or has anything changed for investors?
The chief story is redemptions. You know, I think in the last year or so, the market has shrunk by 4% and by market cap. And that's, you know, net of the gains that preferred shares have been making in that time frame. So it's actually, from a nominal perspective, it's actually smaller than that. What has changed a little bit with this story, the redemption story, is part of what I thought would be going on is, and I think we've talked about it on prior communications, the regulators in this country kind of want bank issuers to move away from the retail space and issue their preferred type securities to institutional investors only. And so the banks have been issuing institutional preferred like securities, you know, LRCNs that we've talked about a couple of times are amongst those. They've been issuing those and using the proceeds to redeem the retail type preferred shares that most of our clients own. What's gone on is, because of what's gone on in the currency market with the depreciation of the US dollar, and also because of how receptive the US corporate market is to Canadian issuers at this time, a lot of the Canadian banks have been issuing this replacement debt in the US market that hasn't come to market in Canada. So there's a bit of starvation occurring in the Canadian market as far as we want to call it sort of mid-quality issuance. You know, this would be triple B sort of type securities that aren't coming to market here because they're able to get deals done stateside. Royal Bank, for example, did a $1.25 billion issue of LRCN a couple of weeks ago. It was very heavily subscribed and got it all done at 6.75. And they're going to be using those proceeds to take out some prefs. So that, you know, yield investors like ourselves and the ETFs themselves that are invested in prefs, you know, are going to get proceeds and they're going to have to spend them somewhere. So it's just going to be more of the same.
Okay. That's all very interesting. Thanks again for joining me, Paul. For any listeners who have not already read our Q2 2025 market commentary, I would encourage you to visit the Insights page on our website. That concludes this recording of Canadian Wealth Wisdom, and more specifically, our quarterly market update series. Thank you.